TPR tells the stories of our city, our struggles and our triumphs. Leaving a legacy gift to Texas Public Radio helps keep those stories alive. Find out how to create your legacy at tpr.org/legacy.
Welcome to Fronteras, a program that explores issues at the border and beyond through the lens of arts, culture, and history. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The Trump administration is actively removing thousands of people from the U.S. How are these removals, or even the threat of removal, impacting the U.S. citizen family members, friends, and classmates left behind? Sociologist Joanna Drebbe conducted interviews during the first Trump administration with young adults who are the children of foreign-born parents. The interviews mostly took place in New York State, an area far from where immigration enforcement action was taking place at the time, along the U.S.-Mexico border. Drebbe found that many of the young people she interviewed nonetheless experienced family separations, changing family roles, and mental health issues that resulted from the immigration crackdowns. Drebbe also heard stories of hope, especially from those who had access to resources. Drebbe wrote about what she learned in the book Surviving the Ice Age, Children of Immigrants in New York. Drebbe says she's long worked on issues related to children in migrant families in Mexico and the U.S.
I was originally from New Jersey, and that's where I had done my previous work. But then I was living in Ohio, and their daily lives were so different, right? In Ohio, there wasn't a concentrated Mexican community like where I had lived in New Jersey. And so I felt really interested in like what it would be like a kid to grow up where you know, almost all the other kids in your class are also in Mexican immigrant families. And in Ohio, where that wasn't the case. Long story short, in doing that project, I kept hitting against this issue again and again of kids telling me they were afraid of immigration enforcement. Kids telling me that their father had been detained. Some of them had a parent deported. And so the project wasn't setting out to look at this issue, but really ended up there. And part of that is because I did the work in 2010, 2011, and that is when the Obama administration had really heightened immigration enforcement tactics. 10 years later, fast forward, I'm living in upstate New York, and I often get invited to talk about my work to other professors' classrooms. So a professor at a nearby liberal arts college asked me to come talk to his public policy class really about an article I had written called The Deportation Pyramid, which kind of conceptualizes the impact of an enforcement experience on children and argues that, you know, the worst case scenario is a kid is separated from their parent. That's what we see in the news all the time. But underneath that all, there are these rippling effects and many, many more children are impacted by enforcement. He told me before I arrived to the class that one of the students in his class had his parent deported, and he just wanted to make me aware of it. So I got to the classroom. You know, I didn't know which student it was, but it became pretty obvious because the class was full of students who were asking me lots and lots of questions, except for one student who was paying very close attention but was very quiet about it. And I became very, very uncomfortable because the questions I were getting were, what happened to these kids over time? What, you know, when they grew up, what was it like? And here I was knowing that there was a young man in the class that had lived this and he was better positioned to talk about this than I was. But of course, I wasn't going to out him to the rest of the class that he had lived this experience. So we ended up meeting. And I talked to him. He was so generous in sharing reflections on what it was like for him. And I kind of went back to my sociology roots and said, you know, I really need to get a bigger, broader perspective on this. So I decided I was able to get some research funding to kind of look at the consequences over time for U.S. citizens who, as a child, had an experience where a parent was arrested, detained, deported. You know, I added a comparative piece to the project. So I had a core group of people whose parents had been targeted by ICE, but then I wanted to have a comparative group. And that comparative group became twofold, one that had an extended family member, and then another group that didn't have anyone in their family targeted by ICE, but, you know, knew about ICE because it's all over the news. And so they reflected in different ways about how it impacted them.
Well, how did you find this group of young adults? How were you able to recruit this really fascinating group of young people?
Yeah, sampling is a really challenge, but a fun challenge for me. And it evolved over time because I started the work in, let's say, late 2018. I think that's when I went to the class. The way I started was to reach out to different youth groups. This was a challenge because most of the people in the youth groups I reached out to worked with immigrant youth, not children of immigrants, right? And I wanted to find U.S.-born children who had a foreign-born parent. Yet still, some of the youth groups I met with had a young person here or there, a sibling that was U.S.-born, something like that in the families in which they were involved. So I started there. I met several young adults with pretty remarkable stories. I actually attended a youth group in the Hudson Valley for about 6 months. I also, again, because I do go to other colleges and universities to give talks, every talk I gave, I said, you know, I'm talking to people who are young adults who've had this experience, and people came out of the woodwork and started to tell me that it had happened to them. You know, they're now in college and they wanted to talk about it. So I worked in this fashion for a year and pretty slowly, because these are intense stories. My interviews were 2 to 3 hours in person, very intensive work. And then the pandemic shutdown happened. So we had to move everything online. And at that point, I changed my strategy a little bit.
How did you change it?
Well, the first thing I did, which is a parallel story, I suppose, so many of the people I teach have foreign-born parents. They're first generation in college. They are children of immigrants themselves, but they don't always talk about it. Now, because the topic can be quite sensitive, I didn't want to send students out to do interviews. But what we did is met weekly and talked about the topic. We did some reading on immigration. I had them workshop with some select interviews that I felt were appropriate to share. And so when we had to move online, we moved to involving those students in sampling and finding people in their networks, because they were all from New York State. So they used social media or people that they knew from home and kind of got the word out that way. And so in the end, I was able to collect way more interviews than I expected. I collected 99 interviews. And then at the end, we did some focus groups as well, with an additional 16 young adults in New York.
Well, let's talk about what you were able to learn from this group of young people. And even though it is sort of this microcosm of this New York community of young people, these are experiences that I think most children of immigrants who have gone through similar experiences that they can relate to as well. And I thought it was really interesting, a chapter that you wrote about silencing, that even though these individuals may not have directly been impacted by ICE immigration enforcement and that their parents or family members did, they still felt a need to silence those stories. Can you talk a little bit about the silencing?
Yeah, this just hit me again and again. And every semester we worked with students, students repeatedly mentioned that this topic of silencing resonated with their own experiences. As I said, most of the young adults who we involved were children of immigrants as well. So it kind of kept getting reinforced. I'd be talking to young adults who are vastly different. And my sampling strategy seeks to, we call it purpose of sampling in sociology. So I wanted to have a group of young adults who I suspected were more affected because their parent was targeted, and then compare them to those who their immediate household had not been affected. That's on purpose, so you can kind of look across the layers. And across all those layers, this theme of silencing kept emerging. And I was surprised about it. You know, on the one hand, it makes sense, right? It's logical. You know, if somebody has a traumatic experience, they don't want to talk about it, perhaps because they could feel re-traumatized. Then there are people who are talking about the silencing in a different way, that they just wouldn't know if someone in their community, someone specific in their community, had this experience, because nobody seemed to talk about it. And there were all sorts of themes of silencing coming up in all these multiple ways within the family, families not sharing full information. And in the immigration literature, this is often described, it's not like I'm the first one to see silencing. This comes up, you know, who do you share things with? Who do you not share it with? And even in my prior work with younger children, I wrote about stigma, this idea that young people don't want to be associated with immigration and may distance themselves because of a stigma. But the silencing didn't match that, you know, as I read over transcripts and heard this story of silencing again and again, it didn't make sense to call it stigma, because young adults told me, I'm so proud I'm Ecuadorian. I tell everybody about my family's background. And, you know, I've been to Ecuador, or I've been to Mexico every summer of my childhood. They talked in ways that didn't sound like they were embarrassed about their family's background. Quite to the contrary, they were proud of many aspects of it. So what they didn't talk about was the migration story. And my takeaway is that when you are growing up in a system, in this ice age where enforcement is a risk, that silencing is protective.
And it seems to be protective in both ways as well, because the parents are also not sharing, or they did not share when these young adults were children, when they witnessed or heard about these enforcement events. The parents were keeping silent about that to protect their kids. But down the road, that also led to consequences as well.
Yeah, it's so tricky. You know, I'm a parent, so I think about this really concretely. You know, you want to protect your child, so you don't talk about certain things with them. It's such a fine line, because if a child doesn't have any information, then their fear and stress and anxiety about something blows up. So there is a really fine line between protecting a child from possible trauma, but also providing them enough information so that they can feel empowered to handle something. I think this is true not just about immigration, but a lot of other things as well, right? And that's a fine line. And it's difficult to, as a parent, it's difficult to figure that out. And then some parents had no choice. You know, they needed their children to translate a document. They needed their child to go with them to meet with a lawyer, and they had to involve their children. Because if you are growing up in the United States and have a foreign-born parent, oftentimes you are doing things like translating, going to doctor's appointments, all of that stuff. Social scientists like to call this brokering work. There's different types of brokering, educational brokering, even things like calling the electric company and trying to work out a billing issue or something like this. This is pretty standard type of thing that a young person who has a foreign-born parent does. But add the legal stress on top of that. Add an absent parent for a time, even if it's a short period of time. Those roles are drastically heightened, and young adults and families are resources. Children are part of family units. They contribute to families. And when a family has such a disruptive experience so suddenly, which is how most people experience an enforcement episode, it's sudden. It's not planned for. It happens suddenly. Children step in, and this can be extremely stressful, particularly when families don't have resources to have other people help out.
Joanna Drebbe is a professor of sociology at the University of Albany, State University of New York. She's the author of Surviving the Ice Age, Children of Immigrants in New York. When we come back, current enforcement actions have triggered past stressors and trauma that Drebbe subjects experienced as children.
They hear of an arrest in their community, all of the worries come back to the forefront.
Our conversation continues next on Fronteras.
Support for this podcast of Fronteras comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. They are committed to helping policyholders build strong and thriving businesses through their exceptional service. More at texasmutual.com/texansdeliver. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Young people who've seen family members confronted with deportation or removal proceedings often silently carry those personal traumas. Long-term effects include self-silencing about those experiences, mental health issues, and an undermined sense of security, even if they are U.S. citizens. Sociologist Joanna Drebbe interviewed 99 young adults in New York when detentions and deportations were ramping up during the first Trump administration. They were all U.S. citizen children of foreign-born parents. One remembers being told by her mother that her father was in police school after he was arrested. Others remember being attacked with racial epithets after the election of President Trump. Another student interviewee remembered minimizing her Haitian heritage to avoid confrontation. Drebbe wrote about the experiences of these young adults in her book, Surviving the Ice Age, Children of Immigrants in New York. Drebbe says she carefully tried to avoid potentially triggering traumas in her interview subjects.
Yeah. You know, every project as a social scientist is a learning experience. You do several projects in the, over a course of a career and find different strategies for each one. This project was even more of a learning experience for me. I have often had the experience in the past before I did this work where people I interviewed would kind of refer to me as a psychologist. Because a lot of people, frankly, don't know what a sociologist does, and it's kind of confusing.
Well, can you maybe break it down for us, maybe?
Yeah. So, you know, a psychologist really studies, like, this is the way I think of it, you know, somebody's emotional, socio-emotional processes in the individual level. Sociologists, we're not really doing that. We're looking to collect people's stories and make sense of them at a group level. You know, what is it like to be born to parents who are at risk of enforcement? What are the types of things that happen, like having to translate or broker for your parents? So my goal isn't to fix somebody or help them move through a psychological process of healing. That's not my job. I'm sort of collecting information. However, most people find that the intimacy of a conversation of someone who's there not to judge them, that's the beauty of it. I come in and I'm not there to judge anything. I'm also not trying to help fix anybody. So I can just listen. And I think most people find that experience of having someone there just to listen and not trying to do anything about it to be really refreshing and useful. That being said, if someone has had an experience of trauma, you know, I'm not trained to deal with that, right? Because I'm not trained as a psychologist. I did do several trauma trainings to prepare for this, but I don't want to trigger somebody in the conversation. So I adapted some strategies. I learned about noticing physical signs, which you would think over Zoom, since I had to move to Zoom, it wouldn't be as apparent, but it was just as apparent. You can kind of tell from somebody's voice some of those triggers. These are young adults. Many of them attended colleges, not all of them, but they're relatively well educated. And I would stop them and I would say, you know, this sounds like it's upsetting you, and that's not what I'm trying to do here. So let's pause and take a minute. And so I found myself doing this often, not with all the people I talked to. I think, you know, I interviewed 100 people, more or less. This is a smaller group of people who felt triggered in talking about those experiences. And yet I wanted to be super sensitive and careful about that. because I don't want to trigger people. I don't want them to be more upset after we spoke. So I would stop, circle back. I also did unstructured interviews. I didn't have a list of questions that I formally went through. I had sort of topics that I wanted to get to. But I started every interview with, can you tell me your story? And let people decide what that story was in their own way, which is different from how I've approached other types of interviews in the past.
Well, the book does cover a lot of what happened under the first Trump administration. A lot of them recall being almost accosted by racist classmates saying, hey, you know, Trump got elected, you're all going to be deported now. Well, now we are on, I don't know, maybe Ice Age, the sequel, where this enforcement, it's really been escalated and exacerbated. So I'm curious if you've actually checked back with any of your subjects since you concluded these interviews and just to see how they're doing.
Well, I have not circled back with the same respondents. Some of them I know informally, so I have some sense, but I haven't gone back and said, what's happening now? I'm worried, you know, as you point out, one thing that came up through so many of the interviews was that moment. It was the 2015-2016 election cycle. Everybody I interviewed remembered that day. I was surprised, you know, everybody remembered where they were, and they had a story to tell about that. Interestingly, I mostly interviewed people who were born in the early 2000s, but there were a few older folks, and they also remembered 9/11 in the same way. But that's very telling because it's like this impactful moment in their childhood. They remember 9/11, and they remember the day that Trump was elected. This is really a very strong memory. Everybody I interviewed, regardless of their feelings politically, I think they all remember this day. So what does that tell me now? It makes me really worried because, at least where I live, ICE is quite active and in the community in ways that that aren't quite. I know I pause. You can hear us pause because I have to state this very carefully. Because I certainly interviewed people who talked about, well, I heard reports that ICE was on the subways. You know, I tweeted it, sent it out to my social media contacts. This has always happened. But where I live, ICE is active in a more present way, and they're also unidentified. You know, they're in mass, and it's very confusing. And that heightens a lot of fears. And I try to do my writing to not solely focus on fears. I think a lot of work does, but to really look at the concrete, what happened to people's lives. One of the things I learned about was how important rhetoric is, because you could be a young adult whose parents had a legal case, an ongoing legal case, which is very common. Immigration cases take years to resolve. They're not determined quickly. So a lot of people I interviewed had someone in their family had an ongoing legal case. Come along the election, all of their fears suddenly are coming to the fore, and they're anxious and nervous, you know, so stressed out about it. In fact, I had one young woman write me after Biden was elected and said, I was thinking of you. I was so afraid this election and so relieved. So the sense of relief, that was her reaction. So, you know, people go along, they have immigration cases. You have to keep living. You can't let that paralyze you completely. So people go along, but then something happens. They hear of an arrest in their community. All of the worries come back to the forefront. So yeah, I feel concerned about young people now. And I feel particularly concerned about young school students who maybe don't have support in knowing enough about immigration to feel empowered and not simply vulnerable to it.
In other parts of the book, you suggest that perhaps ICE and law enforcement might be able to take children into consideration during these enforcement events. But, you know, children now are almost being used as tools of their enforcement activity. So do you see that potentially happening under this administration?
Well, I don't think at the policy level that would happen. You know, yes, I think it's a government theoretically can have some level of enforcement without causing generational harms to children. There are ways to protect children and to protect families and still put someone in removal proceedings if they have been convicted of a criminal act, for example. This can exist. But what I would say in this current era is that, yes, some of the suggestions I have about what can be shifted in the legal system, they seem pretty irrelevant. I think you're completely right. The move is to use children as tools to manipulate children to political ends. So my perspective is that those of us who are aware of this and perhaps disagree with some of the immigration approaches can be in tune to children and work in ways to put children first. For example, teachers, social workers, people who are already interacting with children and youth need to have an eye on the fact that they may become anxious, that they may be experiencing fears, that they may be translating for parents more or other family members, that they may experience a separation. The young people I talk to were able to overcome these episodes, what I call in the book enforcement episodes, when they had good support. And there are a lot of support systems for young people. But if we don't make those support systems awake to the immigration issues that children and youth are experiencing, they're not noticed and they can't activate those networks. So, you know, I think that people who work with young people are in a great position to triage, to notice children that are experiencing immigration stressors, to get them help that they need. And I think that's a great resource. And I think communities have a lot of power to step in and support families so that children don't need to. And all of that can still happen regardless of which administration is in office.
Joanna Drebbe is the author of Surviving the Ice Age, Children of Immigrants in New York. The book examines how enforcement-first approaches to immigration policy harm the U.S. citizen children of immigrants. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Marianne Navarro. Our editors are Dan Katz and Yvette Benavides. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Hear past episodes at tpr.org and on the Fronteras podcast. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thanks for listening.